From PRX and NPR, you're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letson, and today we're in La La Land, city of movies, money, and fame. But that characterization doesn't get at the heart and soul of the City of Angels. In fact, there's a whole bunch of reasons that people are here, trying to carve out a home for themselves and their families. Maybe it's art.
You know, it's really amazing to sit right in front of my house and just stare at it, because you'd wonder, how did this one man do all this?
Or cooking for complete strangers in your apartment.
At that point in time, my apartment was the number one Asian fusion listing on Yelp in all of Los Angeles.
And of course, you can't mention home in LA without talking about the homeless.
I want to watch TV and lay back and not worry about where I'm going to be sleeping or what am I going to eat or not eat.
Los Angeles, California, coming up on State of the Reunion. From PRX and NPR, you're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letson, and this week, we're in the City of Angels.
Welcome to Los Angeles, super city of the future, the metropolis of Southern California.
One of the ways that LA has been portrayed is as La La Land, home to the stars, a plastic city where no one is real.
You don't look happy.
But do I look good?
Inside Beverly Hills Plastic Surgery.
She checked into the hospital.
In LA, nobody touches her. We're always behind this metal and glass.
Or there's the troubled LA, a city hopelessly divided by its economics, race, and violence.
12 Adam 63, officer needs assistance, possible 187.
On April 29, 1992, one of the worst riots in U.S. history began in Los Angeles.
Hey, play your track, people. Hey, you keep running, I'm going to f*** you up.
Elsewhere around Staples, fans started trash fires in various spots on the street. Cops came in with fire extinguishers.
And while there's some truth in both stereotypes, the whole truth is a lot more complicated, tragic, and beautiful. And that's what State of the Reunion does. We look at the spaces in between the conventional wisdom about a place and explore what life is like for people we don't often hear from. And so today, we're telling stories of Habitat, how several groups of people are making a home in this City of Angels. We're on the corner of 1st and Boyle in East LA. As in many places across town, day laborers are milling about, waiting for a potential job. But these aren't construction workers or landscapers in front of a Home Depot. We're at a plaza with colorful murals, tables, and small shops. And these men looking for work are mariachis.
Oh, el mariachi es una cultura mexicana.
Mariachi culture, being a mariachi, is something that transcends through Mexican tradition. So it's come from like our ancestors. It's the kind of music, culture, traditions that come from Mexico.
This is Eleno Caro. He doesn't speak much English, so Janet Favela is translating for us. Now, Eleno is a veteran mariachi musician who's been living and working in the Boyle Heights neighborhood for 18 years. He carries his cool like a rock star, with his dark hair slicked back, sunglasses on, and perfectly ironed jeans. The man has style. And like hundreds of other mariachis in the area, he takes a lot of pride in what he does.
I think it's one of the most important musical crafts that come out of Mexico, and it's one of the crafts that we're able to practice here in this country also. We usually go to baptisms, weddings, sometimes divorces. So anything that would be a party, we're going to be there.
Ay la la la, ay la la la.
From what I understand, like, the mariachi bands come to this plaza and then they get hired out. Can you kind of walk us through that?
De hecho, todos los mariachis que viven cerca.
So a lot of mariachis around here actually concentrate in the area, get a gig, and then disperse from here to all the parts of Los Angeles and sometimes in other counties.
The plaza hasn't always been like this. Actually, it used to be just an ordinary traffic island with a little donut shop. The first mariachis started coming to the area in the late 1960s. As more Mexican immigrants made their way into the neighborhood, the mariachis began to gather at the donut shop for work, and over the decades, it just became a tradition. In the mid-1990s, the city paid to fix up the plaza. The donut shop was replaced with new sidewalks, a sculpture, and a fountain. The ornate domed gazebo in the plaza center was donated by the Mexican state of Jalisco, which is said to be the birthplace of mariachi music.
Que esté esta plaza aquí, que se mantenga.
So it's really a fountain of employment for us. So it's really important that the mariachi plaza and the kiosk stays here so that mariachis can continue to work out of here.
Along with the renovated plaza, other changes have come as well. The mariachis have begun to organize.
Porque yo creo que como en todos los trabajos tiene...
Just like any other job, there has to be like a type of regulation or a type of agreement between the people that are working there.
Arturo Ramirez is working with Eleno to unionize the mariachis.
Respecto a cobro, respecto a vestuario.
It has to do with getting a cost, so prices that are set so that people are charging around the same amount when it comes to people's dress, so that mariachis are presentable and they're representing the mariachis here in the community in a good way.
Janet Favela, our translator, has been working very closely with the musicians for the past 3 years. She's a community organizer for the East Los Angeles Community Corporation, better known as ELAC, and she's seen how vulnerable these musicians are.
Because they charge after the gig, and so let's say I hired a mariachi and I'm some guy that's like drunk, and I hired him for 2 hours, and then I'm so drunk or whatever that I say, oh, play another hour, but then at the end of the night, I don't want to pay him everything, and that happens a lot to them.
ELAC has been intimately involved in helping this community, and the focal point of their involvement is the Boyle Hotel. Sitting directly across from the plaza, the building is known as the Mariachi Hotel.
As you can tell, the room's pretty much just an empty room with a closet. No bathroom, no kitchen.
For years, this rickety place housed dozens of mariachis in pretty squalid conditions. As many as 6 to 8 musicians shared a small studio apartment that had rotting windows, leaky ceilings, and cockroaches. The building earned the nickname Dracula's Castle.
They started moving in the 60s and 70s, and really it starts like any other community starts. A couple people move into a building or a community, then they tell their friends, and their friends tell their friends, and bring families, and it became like the Mariachi Hotel that way.
But then back in 2006, ELAC bought the hotel with the plan to renovate it and keep it affordable for the residents.
And it had 117 violations, and we worked on getting rid of all those violations.
When ELAC took over, Janet had to work hard to win the trust of the mariachis.
It was about relationship building. So when I came into the building, it was about knocking on doors, trying to see like who lived in the units, because we didn't even have documents of who lived in units. You know, who lived there? Were they mariachis, like what their needs were, what they thought the most important like conditions were to improve?
Tenants grew more cynical when they learned they'd have to move out during construction. But the organization was able to find them temporary housing and has promised them first right of return when the renovation is done in a year.
We'll have 31 units in the hotel, and we're going to have 1 or 2 community rooms in the hotel also, rehearsal space. Downstairs is commercial space. And I believe we are trying to get one of those commercial spaces to be like a mariachi drop-in center so that they can drop in and do, you know, like maybe have a meeting, have a cooler, water, restrooms, things that they don't have at the plaza.
All of this, the plaza and the hotel, are important for the culture of mariachis in this part of LA. With gentrification and development creeping into the area, musicians are being priced out of the neighborhood. And for many of the mariachis who need to send money to their families back home, rent increases would make it impossible to get by.
No, it's a restaurant.
Back across the street at the plaza, we meet a group of mariachis getting ready to leave for a gig. They've transformed from t-shirts and shorts into traditional mariachi attire. Tight black pants and cropped black blazer with silver buttons running down their sleeves and pant legs.
Okay, well, my name is Luis Molina. I'm part of the Mariachi Estrella de Los Angeles.
As the only English speaker in the band, Luis is the group's leader. He's invited us along to their show in another county.
San Bernardino is better to take the 605, right? Mejor?
He lives about 5 miles from Mariachi Plaza in Silver Lake. The rest of his band is scattered in Boyle Heights and throughout East LA. few of them come up from Mexico for the busy season between April and August.
You know, this is pretty much an organic mariachi. This is the real thing. My guys have traditions from all their life, you know.
I was surprised to hear that Ramon Rodriguez, one of the eldest members of the group, travels to LA every Friday on a bus from Mexicali, Mexico, 4 hours south of here.
He possibly knows over 1,000 songs, all the lyrics, all the chords.
Because Ramon has joint citizenship, he's able to live with his family during the week and then gig here on the weekends.
You don't find musicians like that everywhere.
After a 2.5 hour drive in rush hour traffic, we pull up to a small banquet hall in Riverside, California. The group piles out of the van. They pull their blazers over their shoulders, adjust their ties, and tune up their instruments. Less than 5 minutes later, they're lined up single file at the entrance of the hall. They make their way between tables of guests and eventually stop on the dance floor and direct their attention to the woman of the hour, 15-year-old Jessica Valencia. We're at her quinceañera, a Latin American version of a sweet 16. Unfortunately, Jessica thinks this is old people's music.
I don't really like it. The parents do. I like English music. My mom wanted to have it. There's gonna be a DJ, like hip hop and pop, like all kinds.
While Jessica isn't excited about her mother's music selection, many of the mariachis we talk to say that the music is as popular as ever. And eventually, even young people come back to their culture. After the band plays a few more songs, they take a short intermission.
This is a very common in our gigs. We come and play for a really nice family. They're very respectful. They're very sweet with us. They invite us to have a drink, to eat. This is what every day is like. To be a mariachi is really nice. We are treated very nice because we carry part of their culture. So for them, they see it as we are very valuable.
Diosito, dame consuelo para sacarme de adentro esto que me está matando. Ay, ay, ay.
Coming up on State of the Reunion, a neighborhood with an infamous legacy reimagines itself.
What we've realized is that by focusing on the home, you know, you can really leverage the skills that people have here so they can improve them home and also ideally be able to grow their businesses or, you know, have gain some financial stability within the process of improving the neighborhood.
Support for State of the Reunion comes from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, a network of listeners, producers, and stations working to make public radio more public. PRX.org. Welcome back to State of the Reunion. Today we are bouncing around LA, stopping at the intersection of community and home. This is a story of place.
The little community of Watts clings to the outer edge of the city of Los Angeles.
Watts started off first as a rancho, Rancho La Tuata, in the late 1800s. From there, Watts and by extension Los Angeles had been dramatically changed by the incoming of industry and migrants because of the railroad.
Community springs from the railroad. Jobs bring families, families bring dreams, but dreams don't always take hold.
It is the last place on earth to look for the extraordinary or for the shadow of greatness.
And yet the seed takes root.
The people of the town have long wondered about Simon Rodia.
Simon Rodia.
Tile setter by trade. Italian born, American for half a century. Builder of defiant towers.
When Simon Rodia started to build the towers in his backyard, you know, an Italian living in Watts was not a a strange thing, you know? I mean, it's pretty common.
33 years of creating art.
With steel girders, with wire mesh, with concrete, with a bucket, a shovel, a hammer, a chisel, and with his two hands.
33 years with sweat on his brow, pushing the interconnecting sculptures into the sky. Higher, Rodia, higher.
Inch by inch.
These are the Watts Towers.
The huge and complex structures that look down from their height upon the plain.
But as Simon builds, the neighborhood begins to change.
By the 1940s, you have hundreds of thousands of African Americans coming to Watts in the South Los Angeles because they could work as part of, you know, the light aerospace industry as well as the automobile industry during the wartime.
By the 50s, things start to fall apart.
Just like Detroit, these jobs started to leave, but the waves of migration still continue. And, you know, when the jobs leave, tax base starts to decrease, social services start to collapse, and because of ancillary housing practices, you know, once you got here, you had no place to go.
This is a story of place. Now made into a pressure cooker, no jobs, white authority versus black civilians. The civil rights movement is heating up all over the country, but right here, unrest is in the air.
There's a suffering in this community. Starvation is a complex that I believe is kind of hard for a nation to look at a starvation that they have created themselves.
Time is running out.
I believe the whites are not willing to accept and recognize the Negro as a human being.
Feeling like the boots on your neck, time is running out.
You're overcrowded. You have no hope.
Watching the world pass by in your stuck, time is running out.
So by the time 1965 rolls around, it starts as a normal traffic stop, explodes into what we know as the Watts Riots today.
At 8:20 p.m., Minicus and his backup officer, his partner Bob Lewis, called for assistance. Minicus tried to put Fry into the patrol car, and Fry's mother, Mrs. Rena Fry, jumped on his back.
As long ago as 1961, and as recently as a few days before the insurrection, a handful of people said things were so oppressive, people so shattered, that the worst could happen.
At 10:15 p.m., several hundred Negroes poured into an intersection, began stoning passenger cars and breaking store windows.
But the consensus, official and citizen alike, was not so, not in Los Angeles, not in Los Angeles.
I'm sorry because you didn't listen.
Not in Los Angeles.
You've been told over and over again this was about to happen.
You can't find the correct adjective to describe the types of situations that are going on out there.
Not in Los Angeles. Not in Los Angeles.
Had his head almost severed.
Not in Los Angeles.
6 days of the sound of fury blasting through the streets, leaving demolished buildings, shattered glass, burnt out cars, and broken lives. 34 dead, over 1,000 injured, and the city is lost. Shh, an uncommon silence. 3 years later, the city of LA unveils the Cultural Crescent Master Plan, an economic, educational, and entertainment stimulus to the area.
But the plan was so big, it was so expensive, that it took at least 30 years for the first part of it to be realized.
What was once a working class enclave is filled with violence and gang activity. City services dry up, and people leave.
So lots of blacks had moved out to Pomona, Carson, Palmdale, West Covina, Sherman Oaks areas. And, you know, folks were encouraged because, you know, there were jobs and opportunities that were there. You know, because in the 70s, you know, there was a rise in gang activity. And then when crack hit the streets in the 80s, I mean, if your family wasn't wiped out by it, you know, you left if you could.
The 90s bring Rodney King.
Witnesses to the controversial beating of a black motorist by Los Angeles police were at odds today on what precipitated the confrontation.
And more violence, and more loss, and now the Rancho La Dorada, built off the tracks of the railroads, standing in the shadows of the towers, settles into an uncommon silence. Today, Watts is about 70% Hispanic, and the awe-striking Watts Towers still stand tall and proud. Just down the street from the public art monuments, it's a small house with a table set up in the front yard. We're at the humble headquarters of the Watts House Project.
We describe the Watts House Project as an ongoing collaborative artwork in the shape of a neighborhood redevelopment. Residents, artists, and architects working together to create changes to both the interior, the exterior, front yard, and backyard of all the homes on the street. My name is Edgar Arsenault. I'm director of the Watts House Project.
The changes made so far include new fences, driveways, gardens, and benches, with bigger plans for knocking down walls, expanding rooms, and even adding an upstairs to one of the houses on 107th Street.
What we've realized is that by focusing on the home, you know, you can really leverage the skills that people have here so they can improve them home and also ideally be able to grow their businesses or, you know, have gain some financial stability within the process of improving the neighborhood.
The homes on this block are small, between 500 and 1,000 square feet.
Within this community, you have a welder on this block, you have two general contractors, roofers, professional house painters, and each one of these people have, you know, go to other communities, go to other neighborhoods and improve them, but, you know, don't have the means to do it for themselves.
What's so unique about this project is that the residents, artists, and architects are all manifesting this collective vision together. The sense of creativity and collaboration on 107th Street today is a far cry from what many people associate with Watts.
Since the riots, people have had that idea of a lot of violence and a lot of gangs.
Rosa Gutierrez moved to Watts 3 years ago. The small home she rents on 107th Street sits directly across from the Watts Towers.
When I found this place, I looked around and I thought, gosh, this could work, you know, because all my life I lived in Los Angeles, I never knew the towers were there. When I saw it, you know, just the fact that my kids and myself, we love art. And I just feel, gosh, you know, this is the right place.
In 1990, the Watts Towers were designated as a National Historic Landmark. And any day of the week, you're likely to find tourists here checking out the massive structure.
Tourists actually asked me, is there a cafe around here? You know, someone where they sell tacos or coffee or something. There's nothing like that. And so we know we are in need of something like that.
As a part of the Watts House Project, a cafe on the block is in the works, and it's going to be owned and operated by one of the neighbors. In front of Rosa's house, she and some collaborators built a bench for the Watts Towers tourists to take a load off and appreciate the art.
You know, it's really amazing to sit right in front of my house and just stare at it, because you'd wonder, how did this one man do all this? To see what people can actually, when they put their minds into it, what they can do and the changes they can do.
And the towers have been an inspiration to Rosa. Last year, she worked with an artist to paint a beautiful multicolored flower along the front of her house and over her garage door. And they also planted a small garden.
You know, it was old little typical house, just like most of the houses here.
But today, Rosa's house is anything but typical, and she now works as a neighborhood coordinator for the Watts House Project.
Since I saw what they started doing, I thought to myself, if I can't afford to be in a better place, and why not make this a better place? I thought of that, and that's when I got more involved with Edgar and started talking more to neighbors.
Like the Sarants, another family living on 107th Street. They're working on a series of low-cost home improvements with architect Roberto Scheinberg and artist Alexandra Grant. Alexandra is a painter and very interested in the power of language.
You know, why I like, as an artist working with language is the most sacred thing, and it's the most profane at the same time.
That's why she's designed a sculpture of the word love that will eventually sit on the Sarants' roof.
The Sarants are a roofing family. You know, that's how they make their money. So the idea of putting a word on their roof actually made perfect sense to them. You know, sometimes the best collaborations are the ones where you inspire people to do better. You may not be warm and fuzzy with everyone, but you inspire them to invest in their own community. You know, and that's what we want to see, is that everyone begins to flourish, that people come to Watts and don't have fear of coming, that we can help reimagine a Watts that's not about the riots in the 60s or the 90s, and that's more than the towers, that community becomes manifest.
Art, in a lot of ways, is really about problem solving.
Watts House Project Director, Edgar Arsenault.
And what we're trying to prove here is that the artistic process need not be limited to just you know, the sculpting of clay or working on a canvas, but it could be, you know, directed towards a home.
I know you haven't finished anything just yet, but do you see a shift in the mentality in this neighborhood because of what you're doing?
What I've seen us doing is not necessarily trying to change people's attitudes towards things, but to shift people's roles and how they participate.
You know, there's always a way. That's something that I have learned. When you got children, you can't just give up. You know, I know it can be done.
Since Rosa's moved to this area, she's gone from being a shy, introverted mother to an active agent on the block who speaks at monthly meetings and knows police officers and city officials.
I was just a gopher in my home, you know, wouldn't come out. Now I want to see things being done.
Now, I don't want the story to paint the picture that if you go to Watts, you'll see a ton of activity happening on the streets, or that the legacy of the area has been wiped clean, because it hasn't. Things don't magically get better. It takes time, patience, and hard work. The participants of the Watts House Project may be moving slowly, but they are moving forward.
It is the last place on earth to look for the extraordinary or for the shadow of greatness.
And yet, it's there. Usually, a home is where you go after a long day's work, where after putting in your 8 hours, you can kick back, relax, and not think about your job until you get up the next day and do it all over again. But in the case of Nguyen and Thai Tran, something that started as an experiment at home has ended up taking over their entire lives.
And at the very beginning, all I did was, I flyered my entire apartment complex, 100 units, then I flyered the other apartment complex, another 100 units, and then I Facebooked. I have about 1,000 friends on Facebook at the time, and she had 400, so we Facebooked, you know, everyone. And then that Sunday, I set up just a table on my back patio, and I see all my neighbors. I'd pull them in, like, hey, come here, you want to try this? And they would try it.
What their neighbors and friends were trying was Pan-Asian fusion, lovingly cooked in the kitchen by Thai. And that first Sunday was such a success that
every week our friends would come back with more friends. They were like, we actually like this, and we brought more people. And after that, you know, when we do on average 20 to 25 people we knew, ended up being 70 people we didn't know. And at that point in time, my apartment was the number one Asian fusion listing on Yelp in all of Los Angeles.
But let's back it up a little bit. Nguyen talks a mile a minute. He's a fiery ball of infectious energy, a salesman by nature.
I love being the center of attention. I love public speaking. I love joking around.
With a personality like that, you'd think he'd be in show business, not hawking food off of his back porch. Becoming a home-based restaurateur wasn't what Nguyen had in mind when he moved to LA from Dallas.
I was pre-med at one time in degrees in computer science. I was a dot-commer for 2 or 3 years. After that, I started up a syndication company. That was my entree to film.
But somewhere along the way, Nguyen learned to just go with the flow and take opportunities as they come. When Thai lost her job in advertising, she started spending a lot of time cooking all sorts of Asian food, then posting those pictures onto her Facebook page.
After 4 months, everyone was like, you're making all these dishes, but you're not making for us. And I was like, you know what? This is enough. We're going to serve out our back of our apartment this Sunday. So are you kidding me? And we got in this big fight and how we're going to do this and how crazy that was. And I told her, look, maybe this is why she was laid off. Maybe this is what she was put on this earth to do. And the thing is, and she had nothing better to do. She was unemployed.
And that is how they became the number one Asian fusion restaurant on Yelp without actually being a restaurant. But then
enter the health department.
And after that, I emailed everyone and said, look, we got found by the health department, everyone. And this is what we're going to do. We're taking it black ops. We're taking it underground. There's a password. Here's the code. Here's how I need to get you in. And here's the menu. By the way, at that point in time, we were not on the patio anymore. When I say black ops, totally. Close windows, close doors. Everything in my apartment.
Unless you're on a mailing list, you'd have no idea that Nguyen and Thai were serving food out of their apartment. With the curtains drawn and the health department threatening to come back, the apartment started to feel like a Pan-Asian speakeasy.
And when we did the black ops, super underground, super illegal thing, everyone was forced to look at each other. And guess what? They were also forced to talk to each other. And they were all forced to like each other. Well, they weren't forced to like each other, but they got along. And they started like exchanging stories, like, so how'd you find them? What's your favorite dish?
How long did the black ops go on?
3 months.
3 months. And then you moved into here.
Haven't seen you in a while. Have you been here before?
Yeah. Okay, you guys go ahead when you want.
Today, Wynn and Ty run an actual above-ground, totally legit restaurant in the downtown business district of L.A. It's called Starry Kitchen.
Well, what I like about it is that the menu changes. So, in downtown, there's only so many places that you can eat at before it gets stale. So, at least here, if you come every so often, you know, every other week or something, there's something new that you can try.
It was formerly a fledgling sushi restaurant owned by a friend of the Trans. But then last year, that guy approached Wynn and said,
"We opened the sushi restaurant. We have no idea what we're doing. We want to give you an opportunity to possibly take over. Do you want to take over? Because, you know, for some reason, what you're doing out of your apartment is getting all this press and all this buzz. You think maybe you might be able to turn it around."
And that's exactly what Wynn and Ty have done. On this weekday afternoon, Starry Kitchen is hopping. The line stretched outside the door. Wynn stands in front of the register, proudly wearing a sandwich board that says, "Please enjoy our balls." He's referring to their spicy tofu balls.
And we have a surplus of them. We actually served like 3,500 of them, and we still have more tofu balls. So,
you know, I always tell people, look, the one thing I want you to do is when you come in here the first time here, I don't want you to forget me or a restaurant, whether you love or hate us. When you walk out, there's no way you're going to forget us. It's like that Asian guy that was really loud and obnoxious who kicked a hole in the wall, gave me the spiel, and gave me some food. The food was all right, but I totally remember that guy.
Actually, the food is more than okay. It's delicious. I tried the tofu balls, and they were amazing! Seriously, if you're in LA, check them out.
So this is what we are in a nutshell. We serve Pan-Asian comfort food. Pan-Asian meaning Malaysian, Indonesian, Vietnamese, Chinese, Korean, what we feel like making. We have is a wrap, a Vietnamese sandwich, and a French baguette.
To see photos of Wynn and Ty at the Starry Kitchen, go to stateoftheunion.com. While you're there, become our friend on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Coming up on State of the Reunion, you can't talk about home in LA without talking about homelessness.
I've basically been on the streets since I was 3. My mom's had money issues the whole entire time. They put me in homes. I didn't like it. So I did a lot of bad things. And my mom got me back, though. After that, I couldn't stand the household anymore, so I just started running away at the age of 13. I've been on the streets ever since.
Welcome back to State of the Reunion. Today we're in Los Angeles, looking at the many ways the concept of home can shape community. And in this city of angels, it's hard to talk about home and exclude those who don't have one.
Los Angeles is known as the homeless capital of the nation.
On an overcast Monday morning, I'm sitting in the back of a van riding down Hollywood Boulevard with two outreach workers.
Well, my name is Reggie Holmes, and I'm a outreach worker for PATH, People Assisting the Homeless.
And my name is Stephanie Pashby, and I'm the Community Outreach Coordinator for People Assisting the Homeless.
Every day, Reggie, Stephanie, and their colleagues pack a van full of supplies, toothbrushes, shampoo, soap, and other hygienic products, and drive all over LA County. They're searching for homeless people to connect them with different social services, and they use these toiletries as a bridge to start a conversation.
So when we approach a person, if it's the first time we're talking to them, we'll kind of use any services that we bring. We've brought hygiene kits today, and we have some snacks in the back as an engagement tool. And if they want to accept it, then we'll use that as the open door to start talking to them about PATH.
Stephanie and Reggie have been doing this a while, and it seems like they have a sixth sense when it comes to spotting homeless people. As we drive down the busy LA streets and pass pedestrians, I have a hard time distinguishing some of the homeless from passersby.
This woman is homeless. You can look at her feet and her shoes. She's very clean, but there are parts of the items that she's carrying and parts of the way that she's walking. You can tell it. She's homeless.
It's an invisible world that, on a day-to-day basis, most of us don't pay any attention to. But according to the Greater Los Angeles Homeless Count of 2009, There are about 48,000 people living in LA County with no place to go on a given day.
We have seen so many that we're not exactly sure about that number.
Yeah, I'll be willing to guess that that number is severely inaccurate, just by, you know, being on the front line, so to speak, on a daily basis.
Stephanie and Reggie say there are many factors that contribute to the high numbers here. Some travel to LA chasing the dream of being a star. Others believe that the living will be easier. But many arrive here and get stuck.
Reality hits them in. Get addicted to drugs, gangs, unemployment, and just spiral out of control there.
And also, a while ago, mental institutions were deinstitutionalized. So a lot of the people that we see out on the street are people that might have stayed in a mental hospital.
Less than a mile from some of the most iconic landmarks in Hollywood, we pull up to a breakfast line that stretches around the block. As we slowly drive by, Reggie spots a small group of youth he's worked with in the past.
What's up, man? How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How you doing?
All right, just doing some outreach, just checking on you. Where you laying your head at?
Laying my hands right over here.
Over there?
You yeah.
Wanna pull over?
Pull over a little bit.
All right, we'll park. You know, come on down. This is Paul here. Paul has been, since I've been in the outreach, homeless. It's going on 3 years now.
Paul's not the clean-cut kid Reggie met years ago. The streets have aged him. You can see it in his walk. The way he looks around when he's approaching is clearly assessing the situation. Paul falls into the category of transitional-aged youth. These are young people between the ages of 16 and 24 who in many cases have spent at least some of their life in foster care. Once they age out of the system at 18, it's not unusual for them to end up on the streets. In fact, according to Mental Health America of Los Angeles, about 70% of homeless young adults here are those who have aged out of foster care.
So where do you guys sleep now?
We're down here.
We sleep right here on the sidewalk right over here.
Yeah, is it dangerous sleeping on the streets?
Yeah. It can be at times, but that's what you carry weapons around for. Well, not bad weapons, you know, chains, things that you can't really get in trouble for.
That's Maggie. She's 17 and looks just like any other teenager you might see hanging out with their friends. She wears an oversized black t-shirt and tight jeans, but it's when you look a little closer, you can see the old stains on her clothes. The dirt under her fingernails.
And if you don't mind me asking, how did you end up on the streets?
I've basically been on the streets since I was three. My mom's had money issues the whole entire time. They put me in homes. I didn't like it. So I did a lot of bad things, and my mom got me back, though. After that, I couldn't stand the household anymore, so I just started running away at the age of 13. I've been on the streets ever since.
Maggie and her boyfriend, along with Paul and his fiance, have formed their own little family. They travel the city panhandling, finding places to sleep and watch each other's back.
We tell each other our faults, and we try and help each other out. I mean, there are some times where we are like brother and sister, where we're at each other's necks, but we forgive each other pretty easily.
At their age, I can't imagine how they survive living in the cracks of society. To complicate matters more, Maggie's told us that she's been diagnosed with schizophrenia, manic depression, and bipolar disorder. Back in the car, Reggie tells us she's not alone.
The more I talk to him, I think Paul has an undiagnosis of mental issues, and that goes undiagnosed because he doesn't follow up with appointments. And we can, you know, point them in the right direction, but if they don't make appointments or follow up with doctor's visits, they go undiagnosed and, you know, it snowballs.
As we drive away, the breakfast line has begun to grow. Many young people join in the line. And while there's a high concentration of homeless youth in Hollywood, the problem reaches beyond city limits. 30 miles east of Hollywood is Irwindale, California, and the Transitional AIDS Youth Hope Center. Of the 30 or so young adults hanging out here, a few play air hockey, some watch movies, others do laundry, and a few others meet with social workers and job counselors, while another five or six learn how to make burritos.
I suggest spreading some of this. This way everything else kind of sticks to it.
The Hope Center really serves as a safe haven for young adults. It's a place where they can come, no questions asked. They're able to take showers. They have a washer and dryer. They have a computer lab, they're taking educational classes, they're able to work toward their goals and take care of their basic needs. I'm Gina Perez, and I'm the Corporate Director of Youth Services for the agency.
The Hope Center sits in an unassuming white building in an unassuming office park in this unassuming California suburb. Pacific Clinics runs the center. They're a nonprofit community behavior health agency.
In the past, young adults that would enter the mental health system would either just go to the children's system of care or adult system of care, and they never had specialized services for their age. So now, through Mental Health Services Act in Los Angeles and the state of California, which is Proposition 63, we have specialized funding for young adults.
And with it, the Hope Center serves as a refuge for any young adult without a place to go.
90% are homeless when they walk in the doors. This youth population, a tremendous amount of them are using drugs and alcohol. And through our evaluation, we found that they're using several substances at once, and they're using daily.
For many, the drugs and alcohol is a form of self-medicating.
So at minimum, they'll have some kind of anxiety, depression, and then, you know, youth age is when we start to see the first signs of psychosis or any kind of psychotic disorder.
I was 16 when I really started to see things, and I started to hear things that nobody else could.
Elizabeth Pena is 22.
Sometimes I hear, you know, voices that tell me to just learn my lesson, shut up, die. I started trying to cut myself. I started trying to jump out of windows. My parents didn't know. They thought I was just trying to rebel against them. They never thought that it was a mental illness or disorder, whatever it is. I'm hoping that one day science evolves to where I don't ever have to hear them.
Soon after Elizabeth started hearing voices, her housing situation became tenuous.
I met someone and I ended up living with that person. That person kicked me out, and from there I had been staying with friends, and I had been going from my mom's house to my boyfriend's house and then maybe sleeping in my car. And then one day I ran out of places to go, and I burned bridges along the way, so I ended up on the streets.
On the streets, Elizabeth became addicted to meth, and the voices became more intense, harder for her to handle. And in the midst of it all, she got pregnant.
But after I had my son, I had something deeper than just baby blues. You know, it got even worse. The suicidal thoughts were much deeper. I can't explain it. It's a horrible feeling. And for the past 4 years, I've been up and down.
Today, Elizabeth's parents have custody of her son as she struggles to find some sort of stability.
I'm applying for SSI. That takes a long time. So I'm trying to get state disability. I'm trying to figure out how I can get money. They don't really want me to work because my medicine isn't stable. I'm still trying to find my little cocktail, you know, of medication that will work for me.
For the time being, she's using her unemployment checks to pay for a room in an apartment. But the money's about to run out, and Elizabeth doesn't know where she'll go.
Home is something I don't know anymore. It's just something I want. I know what it's supposed to be. I know it's supposed to be where you go at the end of your day. But it's more than that. I want to go back to my family. And I want to be 22, you know? I don't feel 22, I feel 45. I don't want to be mature right now. I want to be immature, you know? I want to just be careful. I want to go to school, and I want to watch TV and lay back and not worry about where I'm going to be sleeping or what am I going to eat or not eat. A bed, I would love a bed. I sleep in an inflatable mattress thing. That is not the most comfortable, but it's better than sleeping on the floor.
All across LA, young men and women are struggling to find their place. Some of them have the comforts of home, a mother and a father to help guide them, a support system. For others like Elizabeth, the path to something as simple as home can be filled with obstacles and pitfalls that most of us never even think about. And while it's hard, hope pops up in the most unlikely of places, Whether it's a van rolling down Hollywood Boulevard filled with hygiene kits, a quick breakfast from a mobile kitchen, or friends that have created their own family. Somehow, hope shows up. Every place State of the Reunion travels to, we ask the residents of that area to write a letter to that city or place. And this letter comes to us from Julie Bush, a writer living in Los Angeles.
Dear Los Angeles, we came here because you let us hope. Hope we could still sell a spec feature in the high six and buy a house in the hills and forget everything that happened that got us here. And I mean everything. Hope your upstairs neighbor with the OCD will settle her lawsuit against your other upstairs neighbor, the 18-year-old corn roadie who can't be vocally hamstrung when he's entertaining his ladies. Hope you moved into the right ethnic neighborhood, the one with good barbecue and people known the world over for their politeness and proclivity for robots, instead of the one with the firecrackers and the bandits. Hope you don't RSVP to parties too soon and miss the better opportunities. Hope you don't marry too soon, same reason. Hope your folks forget to check up on what it is you're doing out here. Hope you forget your religion, if you come from one of them religions they do documentaries about and your friends mock in the form of interactive theater at the holidays. Hope your visiting relatives don't wear shorts and don't want to visit City Walk or Jay Leno or your work or your YouTube. Hope no one ever utters the words dry heat. Hope you see all movies on opening weekend and the hottest viral videos the second they upload and the lowest rated TV shows and theaters so underground you have to bring your own shovel to find it. And if not, hope you don't ever want to make conversation in Silver Lake again. Hope you can get friends to come see your reading and your improv and your stand-up and your one-woman show and your puppetry arts. Hope you'll stop being invited to theirs. Hope you never hear the words, "Not in our wheelhouse, we're going in another direction," or "Michael Bay is attached to direct." Hope you learn to fake self-deprecation in order to fend off all the jealousy you'll elicit from people who imagine your life as much better than it really is. Hope you hook up with the right mentor, the right cult, the right alternative healer who prescribes the right supplements, the right biomeridian channels, the right home delivery vegan diet system. Hope you get a show and it's a hit so you can throw your cousin some work, the one whose couch you lived on for 2 years when you first got out here when you still thought you had any chance to make it as a novelist. Hope your vibe and your energy and your essence and your chi all resonate in a gnarly positron annihilation. Hope your project moves forward, and by project we mean life. Hope you love me, Los Angeles, as much as I love you. Thanks for everything. Julie Bush.
At the top of this hour, I talked about the two prevailing notions of LA. One, that the whole city is fake, a movie set rolled out for tourists and packed away once they go home. Or the broken LA, framed in part by the riots and violence of the past, and you can see both when you come to the city. But maybe what you can't see, what lies just under the surface, is the real LA. It's the whisper that tells people who come here, for whatever reason, to stay. It's the homeless aid workers who see heartbreak on a daily basis, and yet they get up every morning and keep going. It's the mariachis whose songs have floated across the border and filled the air with music in this area for decades. And although it has a history as hard as concrete, the hope that grows out of the cracks on the sidewalk in Watts can tell you more about this city than any movie or news report about some random act of violence. In talking to all these people, I got a better understanding for what happens here when the lights on the movie set go down. You see, the director yells, "Cut," the actors leave, and the people that work there, well, they go home.
Home is people. Home is culture. Home is traditions. Home is friendships. Home is food.
And home is really described not just by four physical walls, but it's described by the memories of all the actions that have happened there before. The living room, you know, you have certain sort of interactions there which are different than the ones you would have in the kitchen, you know, or the bedroom is different from the one you would have on the porch.
I have a four-year-old son that I currently don't have with me. He is my home.
I'm not sure what I consider home right now. haven't been here long enough to feel like this is home.
Pues yo creo que es lo más sagrado porque en la casa está convivimos con la familia.
Well, I think home is really the most sacred thing because it's where we enjoy our families, where we're able to share. It's home is when we're sad, when we're sick, when we're angry, when we're in any situation, there's home.
L.A., Home Sweet Home, was produced by Zach Rosen, with help from researcher Marietta Sinodis, beat junkie Willie Evans Jr., and senior editor Taki Telenitis. The rest of the So True staff are producers Tina Antolini, Brenton Crozier, business manager Bree Burge, and Ian D'Souza is the Lord of Logistics. Special thank yous to Jeremy Rosenberg, Devin Brown, Aaron Kazander, Robbie Herbst, the L.A. Eco Village, and the Pacifica Radio Archives. Remember, you can see more of L.A. and the other places we've gone at stateoftheunion.com. So True is distributed by PRX and NPR, with major funding provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Al Edson, and remember, things fall apart. Our job is to bring them back together. Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. The Public Welfare Foundation, supporting coverage of workers' issues. More information at publicwelfare.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.